listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 28th installment of our conversation with Professor Luciana Bone about the history of the USSR. And our fourth and final item on our conversation's agenda set a few weeks back about Trotsky's role in the politics of the Russian Revolution. Luciana, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here this morning.
So we get to put
Mr.
Trotsky.
Morning.
Yeah, here too in New York. I know where you are too. Now, you know,
I'm in Pennsylvania. I'm on Lake Erie.
Yeah, you guys, I know my mom went to school in Buffalo. I know you guys get hit pretty bad. You know, I wish it were as easy to put Mr. Trotsky's impact on socialist and communist movements over the last century or so, to put that to bed as easily as we're going to put the discussion of his role in the Russian Revolution to bed, which I hope we're going to accomplish today. So let's jump in.
Yep. Very well. Well, I am going to jump in with a risk. Okay, I maintain, and I'm not the only one, of course, that Trotsky was unable to think like a Leninist. Thesis. Trotsky was unable to think like a Leninist. And sardonically, I say that's why he invented Trotskyism.
Right. You know, it's kind of like an infant that doesn't know anyone else's language, so they make up their own.
But the reason why we must go through this conversation, you know, we must talk about it, because we live in a period of intense imperialism. So really, you cannot be a Marxist unless you are a Marxist-Leninist, because, of course, Lenin added to Marx the important thesis on imperialism.
Right.
So Marxist Leninism is the ideology of the Soviet Union.
Right.
It is also the ideology of the of China.
Right.
Much as they deny it.
Well, not everybody denies it either. I mean, you know, it's a part of the, you know, a part of the history of the development of the ideology there for sure.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm sorry. I correct myself. Not that China denies
right.
it. It's we Western leftists
right.
deny it.
Right.
Many of us. Now,
I would say many of them personally, but them. But okay.
These pronouns become very confusing.
Yes, I know. They're very slippery. So go ahead. I'm sorry. Yeah. I won't interrupt. Go ahead.
No, no. Very well. So I said that, you know, I'm just making assertions here and hope to back them up with evidence. So you cannot be a Marxist unless you are a Marxist-Leninist in times of imperialism. Now, it follows that if Trotskyism is not also Leninist, Trotsky maintains he's a Leninist. But okay, let's put that aside. Let's just look at how Trotskyism works. If it is not Leninist, then Trotskyists cannot be of assistance in a left opposition to imperialism. And really, you've seen this in the SWP, for example, lack of denunciation of the attack on Yugoslavia. Oh, you know, Milosevic was just a petty bourgeois, etc. So the analysis and critique of Trotskyism, therefore, becomes paramount on the ideological front for recruitment of opposition to imperialism. That's all we need to do.
Yeah, I would say just in very simple, in very simple terms, in deference to people like myself, what we're talking about in essence is Trotsky, say, putting more emphasis on the formality of an ideology and the rigidity of an ideology or a dogmatism, rather than looking at how a particular policy is going to advance the struggle against imperialism. Marxist Leninism looks at imperialism as the, you know, global manifestation of class warfare, and consequently it is the primary and fundamental struggle that has to be won, and absent winning that, the rest is rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. That's essentially
it, right? Exactly. So today's conversation focuses on Trotsky's role in the October Revolution, and it examines the myth and the reality of his involvement in this revolution. And along the way, we discover the errors in his thinking. I will rely a great deal on a Stalin essay of 1924 that's called Trotskyism or Leninism. We may not get to what is Trotskyism, exactly identifying the specifics like permanent revolution, until, unfortunately, perhaps the next conversation. But okay, so we focus on the role of Trotsky in the 1917 October Revolution. Now, according to Isaac Deutscher, who is the biographer, wrote the prophet books on Trotsky. According to Isaac Deutscher, only one person led the October insurrection, and that was Trotsky, not Lenin. I know.
All those statues, those statues around Lenin. Wasn't that, so they called it Trotskygrad? That was, sorry, go ahead.
Okay. Please, you're cracking me up.
I'm sorry, go ahead. Go ahead.
Trotskygrad. Okay. Isaac Deutscher is an influential thinker on the Western left, so that's why we quote him. So it was Trotsky that led the October Revolution, not Lenin. In Deutscher also adds that the Central Committee was ineffective, essentially a Trotsky claim. He endorses that. That means that the Bolshevik Party was ineffective in planning the revolution, that it was, as we will see, divided, etc. Now, we know from past conversations that Trotsky's always been at war with the Bolshevik Party, and that the last act was the August Bloc, which was really a determination to supplant, to destroy the Bolshevik Party by creating another one which combined all sorts of centrist elements anyway. And by the way, Deutscher adds that Stalin was not among the main actors. Now, Stalin was editor of Pravda at the time, and Pravda had a major role in mobilizing the masses.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The Central Committee and Pravda, with Stalin editor, played the key role in mobilizing the militant workers and soldiers. And Trotsky had nothing to do with that. In fact, just before the revolution, I get confused on the dates, but the Russian date would have been October 29th. The revolution took place, in our terms, in November what? It's those days, yeah, it's the like Julian. Okay, but anyway, just before the revolution took place, a military revolutionary committee was put together by the Central Committee to direct the insurrection. And notice the names on this revolutionary committee to direct insurrection. The names were Stalin, Sverdlov, Bubnov, Jasinski, and Yuritsky, no Trotsky. So he was not in charge of directing revolutionary insurrection.
And not only that, so we've discussed earlier, as the formulation of the idea, the processing of what had happened in 1905 and going forward to the early part of 1917, as Lenin came to the understanding that after you have this unrest in the streets and then a rebellion and perhaps an uprising, that to go to revolution, you had to have a military capacity and a military strategy, and that these had been lacking before, which is why it was necessary to fail. They began formulating such a thing, and Trotsky was actually operating and lobbying against that very thing. And so that's the reason that they won power, the reason the Bolsheviks won the day, is because they had in place. They had the weapons were in the hands of the workers, and the workers were operating on a military plan.
Yes, and they also got the military garrison of Petrograd on their side.
That's right, came over to their side, that's right.
By very patient and...
Yep, organizing.
Work. Now, we'll see, we'll get to that, I hope. But just to, to mention the claim, the ineffectiveness of the Bolshevik Party, I mean, the record speaks against this claim.
Right.
Between July 1915 and December 1916, the party had organized 480 strikes in Petrograd with 500,000 participants. On February 14th, 1916, the Bolshevik organized the stay-in strike at the Putilov Works with 30,000 participants. During January, February of 1917, the Bolsheviks led 575,000 strikers. They had organized at least 15 sub-district committees of the party.
Yeah.
So who had done this? Stalin, Kalinin, Molotov,
right,
while Trotsky was in New York contributing to Menshevik papers.
Right.
Do we need to define Menshevik?
I think we have done that, but let's give a very, very brief sketch of it. I mean, the word itself means minority. We're talking about going back to a Congress where the Bolsheviks...
Of 1903.
Right, and the Bolsheviks, this is where you first saw these two different trends developing in the Russian Social Democratic Party, whatever the hell it was called, back, you know, just prior to the 1905, you know, uprising.
Right.
And Bolshevik meant majority, and Menshevik meant minority. The two trends, more or less. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's a little. Well, let's just define. It's a little misleading because the minority and majority applied to the resolution
right.
in the party
That's right.
in 1903 over what the heck was it?
I forget the question, but yes, that the actually the majority was on that question and not in the membership in general.
That's right.
As a matter of fact, the Bolsheviks were talking about the main question was over membership. In essence, the Bolsheviks wanted people
exactly,
who were dedicated revolutionaries,
right.
not just any guy that would join and pay the dues. And the Mensheviks wanted the latter.
It was on the question of membership. That's right.
That's right.
And the smallness of the party. Yes, it was on the question of membership that the Bolsheviks were in majority and the Mensheviks were in minority,
that's
correct?
Right. That's
correct?
Yep, that's right. Yep.
Okay, but basically the Mensheviks stuck to the stages of revolution. They thought that the proletarian revolution would have to follow the bourgeois period. And so they turned into, by and by, into social democrats.
Right.
That is, time is not ripe to, and they sided with the Kerensky government,
right.
which was their death choice. So is it clear? I mean, we must think of them as social democrats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so okay, he was contributing to what eventually, you know, became the ideology of the Social Democratic Party, as we know it in the West, of Social Democratic Parties as we know them in the West. They were reformers.
Right, that's exactly right. They were not revolutionaries, they were reformers, at best. That's just ideologically, because in practical terms, they were actual counter-revolutionaries on the question of some very essential things. Like, for example, ideologically following this, you know, the hard and fast rules of the of development, that revolution can only happen at this stage of development, it had to be an industrial proletariat that was, you know, bringing about the revolution, and therefore an alliance with peasantry, as was done successfully in Russia, was an aberration. It was, you know, counter-revolutionary in essence, according to them. Consequently, we cannot ally with the peasantry, even though we can ally with the bourgeoisie. And consequently, you're dooming the revolution, because the reason that they were successful in Russia was because exactly of the alliance with the peasantry.
Well, yes, and that develops later on into the Chinese idea of socialism with the Chinese characteristics.
Yep.
Why? I mean, it isn't a fact that they eat dim sum or anything cultural Western like that. It's the in Russia, the majority of the population was peasant. Therefore, and this was not denied by Lenin, it was a sort of petty bourgeois revolution.
Right.
And that was the forces that could, you know, those were the majority forces. The peasant and the proletariat had to align itself and then lead it, which is...
Right, that's right.
You know, then cause the transformation, which in fact was done through economic means by Stalin. That is, the transformation of the peasantry into a proletariat class.
Right, by building an industrial base and employing the efforts and labor of the now former peasantry in that effort, which is what they did in China. They turned the largest peasantry in the world into the largest industrial proletariat in two generations.
Yes. amazing. So that was, you know, socialism with Russian characteristics.
Right, that's right. That's exactly right.
Okay. So the Mensheviks, yes, exactly. Reformers, not revolutionaries, is the essential point. And the question of the peasantry with the Menshevik that you just mentioned, Trotsky shared that. It is said that he did not reject the idea that the peasantry had played a great role in the revolution, but that he underrated it. Well, you know, that's underrated it. It was crucial.
Right.
You know, you can't underrate a crucial thing. At any rate. So
right.
these are the Menshevik. So having quoted Deutscher, we noticed that we have two Trotsky's legends. One, that Trotsky played a special role in the October uprising, to the extent that Deutscher called him a leader. And two, that the Bolshevik Party was ineffective. Now, but the question we have to answer is, why do we have these legends? What is the purpose of this legend? You know, for what purpose were these legends invented or passed around?
Right.
And I would say it was to replace Leninism with Trotskyism. That's why we need to know what the points of difference were between Leninism and Trotskyism, no matter how much Trotsky maintains that he was a true inheritor of Lenin.
Right.
But if Trotsky was a Leninist, why do we have two names for the same political formation?
Right.
We don't need Trotskyism if he was a Leninist.
Right.
So in 1924, we know is a key year because Lenin died.
Right.
And at this point, and Trotsky had been pretty calm during the Lenin period, pretty calm, relatively low key, but he apparently began to agitate. He was the leader of the left opposition within the Bolshevik Party.
Right.
And in 1924, Stalin addressed this question in a speech with the title of Trotskyism or Leninism, because there was an agitation by Trotsky, to consider himself the inheritor of Lenin, but there was a movement developing, it was called Trotskyism. So he begins by asking, did, in fact, Trotsky play a special role in the October Revolution? And the answer, not particularly.
Right.
In February 1917, we remember, Trotsky was living in New York. He arrived in Russia in May and joined a faction between the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks. So what was this faction? In a letter to Inessa Armand, Lenin's family close friend, Lenin wrote in May, quote, "Trotsky has arrived, and this scoundrel at once has arrived to an understanding with the right wing of the Novy Mir against the left, Zerwindler." And this was over the question of war and peace, but we don't need to go there. To find out. Anyway, he with the right wing of some war and peace party, that is, with, this is just like Trot, he says. He's always equal to himself. Twists, swindles, poses as left, helps the right. This is Lenin in May 1917.
Right.
Now, Trotsky was allowed in the party in July by the Sixth Party Congress, and we might say, why? Well, many, many others from these in-between groups and even from the Mensheviks, many, many were admitted into the Bolshevik Party. And he was made chairman of the Petrograd Soviet. But at this late date, he could only carry out the words and programs that had been planned by the party over since February, but increasingly in July, August. We'll see, there are three periods. So, in 1924, Stalin assumes this question. All right, Trotskyism or Leninism? So he looks into Trotsky's special role in the October Uprising, and he says, and I'm sorry, but I'll be quoting a great deal. He says, "Let us now pass to the legend about Trotsky's special role in the October Uprising." It's 1924. "The Trotskyites are vigorously spreading rumors that Trotsky inspired and was the sole leader of October Uprising," Stalin says. And he adds, "I am far from denying Trotsky's undoubtedly important role in the uprising," and later on he says he fought well, etc. "I must say, however, that Trotsky did not play any special role in the October Uprising, nor could he do so. Being chairman of the Petrograd Soviet, he merely carried out the will of the appropriate party bodies, which directed every step that Trotsky took," the Central Committee. "For example," Stalin says, "let us examine the minutes of the meeting of the Central Committee, the one held on October 16, 29, in our time, 1917. The question of the uprising was discussed from the purely practical organizational aspect. Lenin's resolution on the uprising, we need to take state power, was adopted by a majority of 20 against 2. The two would be Kamenev and, what's the other one, Zinoviev. And 3 abstained. A practical center was elected for the organizational leadership, the resolution of, on the uprising." He had to convince them that this was a time, for many reasons, to take power. "So, a practical center was elected for the organizational leadership of the uprising. And as I mentioned before, and Stalin says and emphasizes, it was elected to the center."
Sverdlov, Stalin, Dzerzhinsky, Bubnov, and Uritsky. Yep.
That's right.
Lenin's people.
Okay, that's right, Lenin's people. "The functions of the practical center were to direct all the practical organs of the uprising in conformity with the directives of the Central Committee. Thus, as you see, Trotsky was not elected to the practical center, which was called upon to direct the uprising. How is this to be reconciled with the current opinion, 1924, about Trotsky's special role? Is not all this somewhat strange, as Trotskyites would say?" And yet, sorry.
That's okay. I'm
and laughing. "Yet, strictly speaking, there is nothing strange about it, for neither in the party nor in the October Uprising did Trotsky play any special role, nor could he do so, for he was a relatively new man in our party, that is, in the period of October. He, like all the responsible workers, merely carried out the will of the Central Committee and of its organs."
Right.
Now, this does not mean that the October Uprising did not have its inspirer.
Right.
It did have its inspirer and leader.
Yeah.
But this was Lenin.
That's right.
"It is foolish and ridiculous to attempt now, by gossip about Lenin having been in hiding, to obscure the indubitable fact that the inspirer of the uprising was the leader of the party, V.I. Lenin."
Yep. Yeah. And Stalin says, "Such are the facts." You know, if you take a real quick summary of the history also, You know, yes. You're at the early stage. Okay, what form is the party going to take? This is 1903 and subsequent to that. On the one hand, we're going to consist of dedicated revolutionaries who will work and study and gain experience in the development of and conduct of revolution together, who are also to be very closely allied with the Soviets and with the workers in every workers' organization. On the other hand, let everybody in, the more the merrier, that latter being Trotsky. That was the break back 1903, 1904, 1905. Come forward, how are we going to build a mass movement? Well, it should be with the workers and the peasants and the disaffected sectors of the military. That's Lenin. Trotsky, well, we have to wait for the development of the industrial proletariat so it can take its leadership, and we can ally temporarily with the bourgeoisie because that's the next stage in development from feudal relations to capitalist relations to socialism. So, in other words, each and every phase, because now we're at the stage after the revolution, we're on the, you know, on the precipice of losing Lenin, where do we go forward? And Stalin is already complaining about the Trotsky is already complaining about the fact that the party, this professional group of revolutionaries that brought us to this point, you know, that they still have power rather than being distributed to the bourgeoisie, in essence, because that's what he wanted to ally with. Every stage that some crisis occurs or the setting of the stage for the next period develops, Trotsky is arguing the other side.
Mm-hmm. That's why we must consider that Trotsky was not a Leninist. Mm. And if we think that Lenin was the soul of the leader of the revolution, then, yeah.
Right.
Then if we're going to have another revolution, we can't depend on Trotsky.
That's exactly right. And we got to stop there. And we'll pick it up. I guess we're going to have to carry this into one more week. So, Luciana, thank you very much. I'm surprised and glad that we got this far this week. And we'll talk again next week.
Thank you so much, Don. I enjoyed it.
Me too. Thanks. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Sophie & Co. I'm Sophie Shevardnadze. New sanctions loom in the U.S.-Russia standoff. What does a spat mean for the world, and is there an end to it? My guest today is Matthew Burrows, a CIA veteran analyst and a former National Intelligence Counselor.
Chaos in the Middle East, the nuclear threat in Korea, the trade war between Russia and the West. The world order is being tested on multiple fronts. And without a clear bipolar system or a sole superpower, could what we know all be on the verge of collapse? Will a leaderless world balance itself out and find ways to move forward? Or is it doomed to descend into chaos and anarchy?
Dr. Matthew Burrows, a CIA veteran analyst and a former National Intelligence Counselor, welcome to the show. It's really great to have you on our program. So, Matthew, the world is no longer split in two when, like during the Cold War, and clearly U.S. isn't leading the world like it tried to in the 90s. So should we be bracing ourselves for chaos in this new multilateral reality?
Chaos may be a strong word, certainly instability, because I don't think we have really achieved some sort of equilibrium. The U.S. is trying to find a new role for itself, other powers as well.
So, but why, though? Why? Why is it so bad? I mean, we've had a leaderless world for many centuries before, and we were fine.
Well, that leaderless world had quite a few wars in it. And obviously, I think, you know, our own appetite, I mean, for conflict is very, very low these days, and publics are much more eager to see economic improvement than they are to actually get into a fight with a neighbor or with other powers in the world.
How volatile is the current state of U.S.-Russia relations? I mean, do you see more sort of a stability within this confrontation? Or is it teetering on the unpredictable and dangerous?
It certainly is unpredictable. I would say it's potentially dangerous if it keeps at this low level of non-cooperation. You know, we've had differences before, but we've also been able to talk to one another, and we also had those channels of communication. And at the moment, even between, you know, non-governmental bodies, there seems to be a very low low communication between the two.
So is it as bad as the Cold War era, or even worse in a way?
Well, it's worse in the sense that there isn't the communication. I think it is different. The U.S. really sees its peer competitor as China. So in some ways, you know, is not as concerned. I don't share that belief, but is not as concerned about Russia. They see Russia as a declining power, and therefore a power that in their minds we shouldn't have to pay that much attention to. So that is a very dangerous situation.
Donald Trump, who looked like he could be a blessing for Moscow-Washington relations during his campaign, is now conducting the Russian business in an even more adversarial manner than Barack Obama. Why such a U-turn?
First,
well, I think he is hemmed in.
Not quite finished yet.
I mean, I'm not sure that he has changed his views. I mean, his views were always that we should be trying to cooperate together, but he is a weakened president. There's an ongoing investigation, as I'm sure you know, about whether there was collusion between his campaign and Russian authorities. So he can't voice any sort of argument for better relations.
But I mean, he is the president of the United States. Who can ham it in? If he wants to have a good relationship with Russia, he should have a good relationship with Russia. Doesn't his word mean anything? What kind of president is that?
Well, I mean, this is the definition of a weakened president. You know, he has Congress who has passed sanctions almost unanimously. He couldn't veto it. And so he has to abide by that legislation. And he can't actually voice much sentiment for better relations without implicating himself in some sort of conspiracy with Russia or collusion with Russia.
Can the Russia investigation, coupled with possible Democrat gains in the 2018 midterm elections in the U.S., bring matters to a crisis point? An impeachment trial, even?
Well, I mean, it depends if the Democratic Party wins both houses, because it can impeach in the House of Representatives. So with the majority, if it wins a majority after the November elections, it could bring impeachment proceedings. But in order to convict a president and throw him out of office, you have to have a trial in the Senate. And it's not clear if the Democrats can win the Senate. I mean, you know, Bill Clinton was impeached as well, but he wasn't convicted. I think when it comes to it, a lot of legislators, both on the Republican and Democratic side, may actually pull back from going through, particularly with the conviction, not so much the impeachment now. It's been done against Bill Clinton, so there's a precedent.
So the Iran deal and some progress in Syria shows Russia and the United States can sit down and tackle global problems successfully if the need arises. Is this how it's going to be for the foreseeable future? Sanctions and hostility mixed with pragmatic cooperation?
You know, that is certainly, I mean, it's a step maybe in the right direction where you can get more cooperation on different issues. You know, hopefully at some point that cooperation improves. There are a lot of issues like arms control where we need to be talking with one another. So, yes, I mean, hopefully it doesn't stay there in minimal cooperation, but moves up to more cooperation.
The U.S. and Russia managed to deal with the Iran issue together, and now we have another nuclear crisis with North Korea. Can the two countries go again and sit down, involve China, get the Koreans to work things out, pull this off one more time?
It'll be easier for the U.S. to deal with Russia as part of a group of countries, along with China, Japan, South Korea, and others. It is very difficult to, at the moment, to have those bilateral talks, at least openly. And even if you have them behind doors, there are so many leaks from this administration that it's very hard to carry on diplomacy, with Russia. Without that leaking. So yes, I think you could see in a broader setting where you have other powers, you could actually see improvement in the cooperation, and that may build some trust back into the relationship.
Now, during the John Kerry years, there was hope that this approach of working on some issues while clashing over others will actually lead to a comprehensive mending of the Russia-U.S. relationship. But that hasn't materialized. Why doesn't Tillerson continue working this line?
Well, there has been, you know, a sea change, and nobody saw this exactly coming, but you know, obviously there are differences on the interpretation, but most Americans believe that there was Russian interference in the elections. And they see that as an attack on American values. So during the Kerry years, and even before that, during the Clinton years, there was more of a willingness to, in their mind, reset relations after they had deteriorated on one issue or the other. Post-Ukraine crisis, and certainly particularly now with still the investigations on what happened in the elections going on, it's very hard for Tillerson or Trump, as we've discussed, to make the case to the American public that we should have better relations.
Now, despite the hostility, the Americans and the Russians saw eye to eye when it came to fighting ISIS. And now the terror state is all but defeated. I mean, should we expect the U.S. to distance itself from problems like Syria and let it play out?
Well, I would say under the Trump administration, there has been more disengagement. Although there is efforts now in the State Department elsewhere to begin thinking about reconstruction in Syria, I would say in my own mind, I think, you know, both Russia and the U.S. have big interests and share big interests in Syria. I mean, both of us don't want to see more instability or terrorism, but there is a huge disagreement on tactics. You know, U.S. is not making it a condition anymore that Assad leave office. But nevertheless, there's still strong anti-Assad sentiment.
All right, Matthew, we're going to take a short break right now. And when we're back, we'll continue talking with Dr. Matthew Burrows, a CIA veteran analyst and a former national intelligence counselor. And we'll talk more about the challenges that today's world order is facing. Stay with us.
You're listening to Weekday World
from CPR.
And we're back with Dr. Matthew Burrows, a CIA veteran analyst and a former national intelligence counselor, discussing U.S.-Russian spat and other issues causing global concern. Now, Matthew, Turkey, a NATO member, is currently attacking the Syrian Kurds, who are U.S. allies. Is Washington going to do anything about this, or is it going to throw the Kurds, to who rely on it, under the bus?
I think Washington is very concerned about Turkey and where Turkey is heading. So, yes, their efforts to warn Turkey against its attacks. But, you know, it is a NATO member. There's an effort not to alienate further Turkey. There has been, you know, tense relations between U.S. and Turkey for some time. So I think the effort is to handle this in a very low-key manner out of the public eye.
Does the U.S. even have enough leverage to stop Turkey anyway?
I don't think we have the leverage. You know, there's... I mean, in the past, Turkey has taken unilateral actions that have highly displeased the Washington. Turkey believes that this is very much a threat. And, you know, in the case of any country that believes that they face an existential threat from some source, it's very hard to deter it from carrying out actions to eliminate that threat.
Now, for decades, you've been analyzing and predicting world crisis for the U.S. government. How do you expect the Turkish intervention to unfold, and what consequences will it have?
Well, hopefully Turkey doesn't. I mean, that it's warning the U.S., but does not, tries to avoid hitting certainly U.S. personnel and also draws backwards on its actual actions against the Kurds. You know, as I say, I think this is a difficult negotiation, but I don't think Turkey wants to completely alienate the U.S.
Pentagon has recently revealed a new U.S. defense strategy, which says that interstate strategic competition with Russia and China is a number one concern for the U.S. Is terrorism no longer the biggest threat to America?
It isn't. I mean, this is a dramatic switch. It obviously, terrorism is still a big threat. And, you know, any U.S. president does not want to see a repeat of the 9/11 episode. So we have been hardening our borders and we continue in the Middle East and elsewhere cooperating with countries who are fighting terrorism and following also the spread of extremism in the U.S. or elsewhere, to try to dent any terrorist attacks. But increasingly, you know, U.S.'s foreign policy elite believes that we're falling behind China on technology, certain technologies, or that they're moving ahead on certain technologies. And they actually, despite having lots of problems with how foreign policy is executed under President Trump, actually, the foreign policy elite, both Republican and Democrat, would agree with those statements in the National Defense Strategy.
Is the U.S., in effect, abandoning the war on terror and returning to a Cold War type of thinking? And if so, why?
I wouldn't say it's abandoning totally, as I talked earlier, but I do think that it does worry that its margin, I mean, the U.S. believes, and if you go back the past 20 years, you know, there was a period in the 90s when the U.S. believed it was the unipolar power, so clearly above every other power in the world and able to take unilateral action. What you've seen in the last decade or two is the fact U.S. seeing China particularly rise very quickly. And there is a worry on the economic side. You know, China is 6-7 years away from becoming the biggest economic power in market value terms. So that is the concern. I think we're approaching, in an interesting way, another Sputnik moment. You know, as you remember, in the 50s, when the U.S. worried it was falling behind the Soviet Union in technology development.
Russia and China are called revisionist powers that want to shape the world under their model in the latest U.S. defense strategy. So to me, it sounds that an American mindset, there is the American worldview, which is right, and there is all the rest, which are incorrect or adversary, revisionist, and need to be confronted. How can the U.S. exist in a multipolar reality with this type of unipolar mentality?
Well, that's a big difficulty, and that's something that I've been worried about for years, because I think the U.S. is going to remain a great power in whatever sort of world order we have. But if it continues to play its cards, you know, like it did in the 90s, believing it was a unipolar power and could do these things unilaterally, then I think we could be in for a rough ride, because I don't think it's just not China or Russia, but I don't think other powers want to see a unipolar world with the U.S. as the top power.
Now, in your book, The Future Declassified, you say that America has to take charge and direct the needed changes in the world. What about all the countries of the world that aren't excited about the American direction? I mean, do you think they should be forced into following America's lead?
No. I mean, I think what you earlier said about a polycentric world is correct. And if you have a polycentric world, then that means that the U.S. has to sit down with other powers and players in the world, and we have to think about how we can work together. We do have enormous number of, and we've talked about some of these, shared interests. So the effort should be thinking about how do we cooperate in dealing with these shared interests.
So I understand you're talking about the U.S. adopting a sensible strategic policy and going through with it, but if we try to look at it from a non-American point of view, we see that since the Iraq invasion in 2003, American foreign policy has been impulsive and quite chaotic and focused on its own interests rather than the common one, and has contributed to the mess in the Middle East rather than solving anything. And after two decades of this, how can the U.S. regain the trust of the international community in its leadership ability? Because, I mean, so far, and I repeat, from an outside point of view, it's not been too good.
Well, I completely understand, you know, your view on it. And I think many Americans would also share your view that the invasion of Iraq was a strategic blunder and disaster for the U.S. And they were very unhappy about, and that's why the popularity of George W. Bush went down in his second term. But, you know, Americans look on this as, well, we had good intentions. We were trying to deal with what we thought was a threat of weapons proliferation. And in Afghanistan, we are trying to rebuild the country. Now, that doesn't the good intentions doesn't excuse what happened and the disarray that happened in the Middle East. But that is still how a lot of Americans look on that. The rest of the world is very focused on the disastrous results. The U.S. public and elite tends to think much more about the intentions were, and seeing those as good intentions.
Almost a decade ago, about 8 years maybe, you said cybersecurity was a top threat. Now, the Pentagon has recently proposed writing a nuclear response to a devastating cyber attack into the U.S. military doctrine. What kind of a hostile action in cyberspace would merit a nuclear attack?
Well, I think in the Pentagon's mind, it would be to disable critical infrastructure. So, for example, like the electric grid in the U.S. or the functioning of financial institutions in the U.S. Now, whether that would actually, I'm not sure that even those actions would, they certainly don't justify, in my mind, a nuclear attack. But I am not sure if they would actually trigger one, because I think, you know, most Americans are very scared about what would happen after they did trigger a nuclear attack, and that would be particularly against Russia, China, or another nuclear power. There would be retribution.
Oh, Dr. Barros, on that optimistic note, thank you very much for this wonderful interview. We were talking to Matthew Barros, a CIA veteran analyst and a former National Intelligence Counselor, about all the major challenges that put our world order to test. That's it for this edition of Sophie & Co. I'll see you next time.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.